Okay, good morning, everybody. 10:20 on Wednesday, July 1st. Happy July. A couple of announcements this morning. Number one, I put up a new suggested homework assignment and reading assignments for Chapter 3. So we've done all the work that we need to do there in terms of Chapter 3. We're going to move into Chapter 4. And so there's a new reading assignment and new homework assignment up. And I did not do the answer key to that homework assignment just yet. I will get that or try to get that today and get that up and posted, as well as trying to get some other new assignments up. We'll see what I can do with quizzes. I'm trying to figure out how to do compounds in a quiz format on Canvas is not, I don't know, I got to wrap my brain around how to do that just yet. So it's going to take me a little bit of practice. So that's the first thing, is there is a new assignment up, new suggested homework for Chapter 3 on Canvas. The other thing is, you guys were hopefully trying to finish up that exam one by last night. If you have not finished the exam, then I need you to try to move forward with the exam and get that finished up. So exam one is still open, but hoping that you guys go through and try to finish that today if you can, so that I can get it graded and get everybody updated. I already started going through and looking at those people who had completed it and turned in the assignment. I have tried to go through and make some notations on it and complete the grade and look at whatever files you submitted and award partial credit. And I've been fairly consistent in terms of rewarding or awarding that partial credit. For instance, if you had a sig fig answer on a 10-point question and Canvas took 10 points away, I'm going back and putting 9 points out of the 10 back onto your score, because I consider the correct answer, correct answer. You've shown me the entire skill set, you just made a sig fig error, and I only take 1 point off for a sig fig error when I go through and do that. So in many cases, some people were having exam scores because they had consistent sig figs issues, and the exam score was in the 60s. And by the time I went through and finished regrading that exam, it took it up into the low 90s. So So if that happens to you and you have a lot of sig fig issues, know that I'm going to go back and I'm going to regrade it and correct it. And if I don't, for some reason, if I miss your exam, or if you feel that I missed a sig figs issue or something in your exam, then don't hesitate to contact me. Send me an email. Let me know that something looks amiss, or that you would like me to review something or look at it or explain to you why you lost the points that you did, what was wrong with it, and how you can improve it. Don't hesitate to reach out to me by email or office hours. And I'm happy to go back through and look at your materials and explain to you either why it's graded it is the way it is, or apologize to you and fix it and apologize for missing it the first time through. Okay. So those things are there. And then let's see, how many people do we have? 33. We're still climbing. Some people may join in yet. The afternoon lab, this afternoon, I need to cancel this afternoon lab. So canceling the afternoon lab. And we went through and we did this morning some more work on nomenclature and did some more practice. It was mostly a practice-based thing rather than me explaining a whole bunch of ideas and concepts. It was much more of a practice-based exercise. And so if you are in the afternoon lab and you would like to go and watch the morning one, ooh, I won't be able to get it posted fast enough. I was going to say you could just go and watch that, but no, I'll have to try to get it posted. And maybe I can do that a little bit earlier since I'm canceling that afternoon lab. We'll see what happens. I have a job interview this afternoon. It is a job interview with Cabrillo. So it's just looking at changing some of my duties. I am one of the more experienced chemists in terms of lab and in terms of actual chemicals and the use of chemicals. And Cabrillo needs what's called a chemical hygiene officer, which sort of directs the safety within the department and looks at all of the chemicals that we utilize within the department and makes decisions about the proper use of those chemicals, the proper storage of those chemicals. Has to do with making sure that all faculty are trained in the proper way to deal with those chemicals, and all of the compliance that we have with OSHA in terms of the inspections of our facilities, the inspections of our equipment and our safety equipment and all of that stuff. So the chemical hygiene officer is sort of in charge of all of that. And that's the job that I am applying for and looking at possibly doing. So we'll have to see. I don't know if I really want that job, but Cabrillo needs a chemical hygiene officer. The chemical hygiene officer needs to be an employee of Cabrillo and also needs to work in the lab. And so they also need to be an instructor that works in the lab and participates in all in that. So that's, yes, and I'll still be teaching. So I won't, I don't know if it goes with a raise. See, this is the thing, is I don't know if I really want this job or not. If it goes with a demotion in salary, I don't know if I want that. But Cabrillo needs a chemical hygiene officer. And so many people have encouraged me to fill that role. And so we'll see. It's a conversation. It's an interview on both sides. I'm interviewing them and they're interviewing me. We'll see if we agree or not on whether or not this is what I want to do. But I'll still be teaching regardless. It is only about a half-time position. And so the other half would still be teaching. So I'll still be teaching organic chemistry. I'll still be teaching some of the Gen Chem, and we'll see how that goes. So that's what we're thinking about here. That's what I got to go do this afternoon. All right. I have done almost everything I wanted to do in Chapter 3. There was a couple of things in Chapter 3 that I feel that I should talk about for a few minutes before we jump into Chapter 4. And then we'll look at Chapter 4. Chapter 4 is great. Chapter 4 is where we really start getting into some fun stuff. So let me bring a periodic table into this discussion. And from this periodic table, we can talk about a couple of ideas in chapter three that we did not cover. So in chapter three, what we did not cover are periodic trends.
I have a super quick question about the exams.
Yeah.
With the second attempt, are we allowed to wait until we get our partial credit back from our work to see, like, if it was just a sig fig error, or would you rather have us do the second attempt just immediately after?
I would rather have you. So the first attempt is supposed to show you after the first attempt what you got wrong. It's supposed to show you what parts of the problem are wrong. If you're curious or need some support after that and can't figure out where to go, then I would say jump into office hours.
Okay.
And I can look at it and I can give you some direction or try to point you in the right direction and tell you whether it's just a sig fig or whether it is a bigger error that you're experiencing.
Okay.
The idea was more so for you to kind of do your work after the first attempt, try to figure out what you need to do, do the second attempt fairly quickly, and then have me go in and reprocess it. So I don't want to sort of reprocess it in the middle. That's going to take too long for us to be able to go through and do that. But I am certainly willing, in an office hour sort of sense, to take a look at it and give you some direction if you need that.
Okay, awesome. Thank you. I was just confused about, like, where the second attempt was supposed to fit in with, like, okay, cool. Thank you.
Yeah, the second attempt is sort of like the quizzes. Is you try it first, you see what you got wrong, go back, do a little bit of extra work, maybe looking at the notes, maybe reviewing some of the lecture content, and then to jump back in and do that second attempt in a fairly timely manner, rather than waiting for me to go in, make corrections, and then try it again.
Okay, awesome. That's, that makes sense. Thank you.
Yeah. So and what I'm seeing too is I'm seeing that the scores on the exam, particularly after I go in and award partial credit, are fairly high. A lot of them are in the 80s and 90s. And I think there's a couple of them that are already at 100%. So how do I feel about this in terms of grades? What is my personal teaching philosophy in terms of grades? My personal teaching philosophy is I'm here to teach you guys. I'm here to help you learn the material and to reach your goals. So my goal is to help you to learn the material. If giving you two attempts on an exam helps you by finding out what you're doing wrong, you go and learn it. You then reproduce it, do it correctly, and put it in the second time, and you get a score that is commensurate with understanding of the material, which is a high score in the 80s or 90s, then I have done my job in helping you to learn the material, and you have shown me that you have learned the material. And so I don't feel that I need to have grades that are all in the 70s with people getting C's and D's. I would much rather have you learn the material, and the reason for putting the two attempts on that is to show you where you're making some mistakes, and let's go and make it right. So that's sort of my teaching philosophy. So I don't mind the grades in the class being higher. In fact, I sort of like that because it's showing me that you guys are learning the material. That's my goal and that's your goal. That's going to take you forward and help you in the next class. And so your grade should reflect that. That's the way that I look at that. Anyway, okay, enough of that. Let's jump in and look at these periodic trends. So there's a couple of periodic trends that I want to cover. One of them is size. So size being the size of atoms and ions. And the second one being one of electronegativity. And there's another one that is closely related to electronegativity, which is electron affinity. Electronegativity and electron affinity are very closely related. The difference between them is that electron affinity is measurable. This is done by experiment. The size, likewise, is measurable. And we look at the actual radius of the atoms in and of themselves. Electronegativity is not measurable. This is a calculated value based on other properties of the atoms. But it's very similar to electron affinity. So what they do with electron affinity is they take an ion, they put an ion in the gas state, and then they throw an electron at it, and they look and see how much energy is released when it captures the electron. So basically, we take an atom. This is in a gas phase. And we throw an electron at it, and this thing captures the electron, so it becomes an atom now that is an ion. So it has a charge on it, a negative charge, still in the gas phase. And out of this comes energy. Energy is released in this process. When you make a bond, energy is released. And we measure this energy in kilojoules per mole. And that's the amount of energy. And that is the electron affinity. Electronegativity is the measure of how strongly an element pulls electrons or holds electrons, which you would think that this electron affinity is the same thing. And they are, essentially. But one is measurable and measured in kilojoules per mole, and the other one is unitless and is a calculated unitless value. So they're very similar, but subtly different. And these trends are important in moving forward as we start looking at covalent bonding. It's important to understand both size and really electronegativity, not so much the electron affinity, but the electron affinities, I believe, are used in calculating the electronegativities. And so how can it be unitless? Unitless, some values that we use in chemistry are unitless. When you divide something like milliliters by milliliters, you get a unit, which is unitless, or you get a value, which is unitless. So somewhere in the calculation of electronegativity, we are dividing by two units, which cancel each other out, and you result in a unitless value. Still a measure of something important, but has no units associated with it. It's a sort of a unique concept. So first off, let's deal with size. So we'll throw a couple of different periodic tables in here and we'll look at size. When we look at element size, size is proportional to the number of electrons because the electron cloud is the volume of an atom. Size, we say, is proportional to the number of electrons. The more electrons you have, the larger the atom is. And so as we go down a group, going down this way, elemental size increases. So we have increasing size. Helium starts off fairly small. Neon gets bigger, argon bigger, krypton bigger, xenon bigger. Each one of these elements is getting bigger in size because they have more electrons around them and a bigger electron cloud. So they increase in size going that direction. In general, going this direction, the size decreases. This is counterintuitive. Boron is actually bigger than is carbon, than is nitrogen, than is oxygen, than is fluorine. And yet, the number of electrons are increasing in that direction. So why is that with boron, carbon, nitrogen, and oxygen that they continue to increase? The answer has to do with the electronic configurations and shells to some degree. When I look at boron and the number of electrons that boron has and electronic configuration for boron, boron is 1s2, 2s2, 2p1. And then carbon goes 1s2, 2s2, 2p2. And nitrogen, 2p3. I'm just going to catch the last electron. It'll be a little bit easier for all of us. Oxygen, 2p4. Fluorine, 2p5. And then finally, with neon, 2p6. So it has the other component in front of it as well. But what's happening is we're adding one electron and one proton. The nuclear charge, when I look at the nucleus, if I think about the nucleus as being slightly larger, the nuclear charge pulls on the electrons. So the positive charge, which is here, pulls and attracts the electrons. And so when I look at boron, and I think about this electron cloud that is around the outside of boron, and the nuclear charge, that there are five protons, five positive charges in the nucleus, and this electron cloud out here, and the entire cloud is made up of five electrons, it has a particular size. When I go to carbon, and I put in now six protons, even though there are six electrons, the electrons get pulled in a little bit tighter because that one extra proton pulls them in a little bit. And that continues to happen as I go down the periodic table until I get to fluorine, where in fluorine now, the fluorine atom with its nine protons, nine positive charges, and its electrons, nine electrons, even though I'm adding an electron each time, that nuclear charge keeps condensing and pulling the electrons tighter and tighter together, making the atom a little bit smaller. Well, why doesn't that happen when I go down a family or a group? When I go down a family or a group and we look at the difference between helium and neon, so down a group now, the difference between helium with its two protons and its fairly small cloud of two electrons. So we think of this guy as being kind of small. And I go to neon. What happens in neon is the electronic configurations here are 1s2. And then in neon, it's 1s2, 2s2, 2p6. What winds up happening is all of these electrons here are shielded by this filled shell. So if we think about it like this, here is my two electrons that are here in the 1s shell. And then around it, I have the additional 8 electrons that are out here in the principal energy level 2, the 2s and 2p. And the nuclear charge that is in here that is 10 protons is somewhat muted by the closed shell. This shell here, that is the 1s shell, sort of dampens the electrons' ability to be able to feel these 10 nuclear charges. And that allows this shell to expand out and push out and create more volume, even though there are more nuclear charges. So a filled shell shields electrons outside of that shell. And we're using that word shell, I should really use it as level. A filled level shields the outer, another term for those, valence electrons from the nuclear charge.
Which makes them more likely to react?
Not more likely to react, but allows them to be a farther distance from the nucleus, allows more volume, allows the atom to obtain a larger volume. See, when we march across this way, when we march across this direction, the shell is not filled. We are actually just putting more valence electrons in. And so the nuclear charge is effectively pulling tighter and tighter and tighter and tighter because we're adding one more proton. We're increasing the nuclear charge at the same time that we're adding electrons. But here we fill a shell. And when we fill a shell, the inner shell protects the outer valence electrons. So the outer valence electrons are allowed to expand. We fill a shell and we throw some more valence electrons on top of it. We fill another shell and more valence electrons. And so each time the atom gets bigger and bigger and bigger because it's got more shielding on the inside of it, shielding the nuclear charge. So size increases going this way. Size decreases this way because we haven't filled a shell yet. We're just marching along. And so we can see this trend that here at aluminum, aluminum starts off pretty big, and then we march smaller and smaller and smaller until we get to neon. And so going down, we're always going to see that we do get bigger as we go down, but going across, we're always going to get smaller.
And is that just circumstances that cause an effect, or is there like a biological benefit?
There's no biological benefit. It's not, there's no benefit to it. It is just a cause and effect of shielding of the nuclear charge. And you can think of it, remember here that we have subshells, right? That this is the S block, the D block, and the P block. What winds up happening here is the same effect for a subshell. For instance, if I look at rubidium, rubidium is really big, and then strontium gets a little bit smaller. And then I filled out a subshell. And when I go to yttrium, yttrium starts out a little bit bigger than strontium, and then has a fairly simple march, and then a little bit bigger again, and a simple march towards smaller, and then a jump again, and then a march towards smaller again. And so each time we get a filled shell, we get some expansion. We march until we get a half-filled shell, and then we get some decreasing. And then we get some expansion, and then just decreasing again. And so those size trends march across the periodic table in that way.
When it gets bigger again, does it repeat like a pattern of getting smaller after that? Or is it like
yes,
ones are outliers? Oh, okay.
No, Ayla, you're absolutely correct that once it expands, like here, then it shrinks again until it expands again at the half-filled spot, and then it shrinks again, and then it expands because we go to a new shell or a new subshell, and then it shrinks again. And so those patterns just kind of repeat. Sierra, I'm probably spelling it wrong. It probably is N-U-C-L-E-U-S. Spelling is not my forte, and I apologize. That's just one of the things that comes along with the package. Vanessa, but is 1S2 in carbon is filled as well, isn't it? Yes, Vanessa, but it was also filled for boron. And so what happened is I threw an electron in addition to what boron had, and yet I didn't fill a new shell. I'm just filling electrons on top of it. And so given that I haven't filled a new shell, the increase in protons pulls the electrons in a little bit tighter, and that pattern continues.
So that change is reflective of, like, I'm just looking at the line where we have the most circles drawn. So that, like, fluctuation in the size of the, what is that, the valence, the shell, the outer thing?
That's one way to say it, yeah.
Okay, cool. Is reflective of, like, the levels that are getting filled?
Yes, in a way. Yeah. In that this is a sublevel. So right here, we're filling the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. That would be the 5S. Mm-hmm. So the 5S gets filled. And once the 5S is filled, I march into the 3Ds, 3Ds being higher in energy. And so there's some expansion that winds up happening because I have a filled sublevel below it. These expand. I march until I halfway fill that level. And then there's a little bit of expansion. And then it shrinks again. I have now filled the 3Ds. I march back into the 4Ps because the 3Ds have been entirely filled. There's a good amount of expansion that happens for this 5P until it marches down to be smaller and the whole pattern repeats again.
Is it like, I'll type it out actually because this is really fun.
Ellis, I didn't catch the question. Did you get it? It sounds like maybe you figured out your own question there. And Eric, whenever there is expansion, does it ever exceed the size of the previous expansion? I don't know. That's a good question. I sort of just know it in terms of trends. I never actually look at it in terms of the actual size of the elements. It's just for me, in my use, particularly as organic chemist, that fluorine is one particular size, and chlorine and bromine and iodine, that I think of fluorine as being a fairly small atom. Chlorine gets a little bit larger. Bromine is big, and iodine is massive. And that has implications in the size of the atom in terms of how it bonds and the types of bonds that it makes when we get into the covalent bonding. And it has to do with the bond length, and it has to do with three-dimensional structure. So it's important in terms of three-dimensional structure, and it comes back again in organic chemistry and bump up. You want to go, I don't know where you want to go, either here or the periodic table. I wasn't sure.
Quick question.
Yes.
Doesn't like nitrogen or oxygen, for example, don't they have a -3 and -2 charge? So don't they already have more electrons than protons?
Vanessa, that's a great question. And to your question, Vanessa, that when fluorine picks up an electron to become a fluoride, so I add an electron to it and it becomes an F minus, one of the things that happens is the size of the ion gets bigger. So the ion size, which has an extra electron, is bigger than the nuclear size or bigger than the elemental size. So if I look at these as the element, and then I look at this as the ion, that the anions increase in size. So as I add an electron onto chlorine, chlorine becomes chloride, and its size likewise increases. For the cations, when I look at sodium being a particular size, if we say this is the original size of sodium, and it loses an electron and it goes to become a sodium cation, the cation is smaller in size. So the cations decrease in size from what they were as an atom or an element. So I could say the element itself. And here it is an ion. As an ion, cations get smaller. Whereas anions get larger. And then I think to speak to your question a little bit more, I can look at the difference between fluorine, oxygen, and nitrogen. Fluorine, which gains a single electron, oxygen, which gains two electrons, and nitrogen, which gains three electrons, such that we are going to F minus, O2 minus, and N3 minus. So we have the fluoride, the oxide, and the nitride. Size-wise, nitrogen is the larger, oxygen a little bit smaller, and fluorine a little bit smaller yet in terms of their elemental size because of the way that they are in the periodic table. I'm not certain, but I would hazard to guess that when I look at the N3 minus, the O2 minus, and the F minus, they are going to be very close in size because they all have the same electronic configuration. This is 1s2, 2s2, 2p6 with a single negative. This is 1s2, 2s2, 2p6 with two negatives. And the same electronic configuration here, 2s2, 2p6, with three negatives. The difference being the number of protons. Fluorine has nine protons, nine positive charges. Oxygen has eight protons, eight positive charges. And nitrogen has seven protons, seven positive charges. So the smaller the nuclear charge, the more the electrons are allowed to expand. So I would expect that nitrogen would be the largest. Oxygen would be a little bit smaller, and fluorine a little bit smaller than oxygen because it has the most numbers of protons that are here. And so that contracts and pulls the numbers of electrons in. So we still see that the size trend follows suit, whereas nitrogen was a little bigger, the oxygen smaller, fluorine smaller. The ion will be bigger for nitrogen. And even though they have the same numbers of electrons, they will still decrease in size marching towards the fluorine because the fluorine has a greater number of protons.
Cool, thank you.
Cool. Eric, what Ellie said then, electrons want to expand, push out, whereas protons want to contract, pull in, yet protons win in a battle 1-to-1 until the shell fills. Yes, in essence, the electrons, you can think of the electrons as being in a cloud. So we have this electron cloud that is here, and yet individually, electrons are like charges and they repel one another. So the electrons are essentially seeking space and pushing out and expanding in order to decrease the electron-electron repulsions. And yet in the nucleus, this is where the positive charge is contained. And so the positive charge with an electron is an attractive force, and they are pulling on each other. And so they are pulling in this nuclear charge is effectively contracting and pulling in on the electrons. And so, yes, there is a tug of war, and there is a balance there that winds up being established. And that is the balance that is the effective size that we are looking at on the periodic table. So we're seeing that tug of war playing out, and we're seeing some interesting effects in that tug of war, which is that a closed shell effectively shields the nuclear charge when we have a closed shell. So that's what we're seeing play out there. Sort of a cool concept.
I'm confused about something.
Okay, Kerrigan, go for it.
I'm not quite understanding like what it is that's changing this. Like you had said something just a second ago and it was really good. It was like the number of protons is making something happen. But I guess like what what am I trying to understand here, I guess, is my question.
All we really want to understand is the size trend in the periodic table. And that there is not just a continuum where they just continue to shrink.
Sure.
But that they shrink, expand a little, shrink, expand a little, shrink, expand a little, shrink. And that every time I get a closed shell, the next electron that goes in after a closed shell will expand. And then it starts this march of shrinking again. That's all we're trying to understand.
Okay. And what is causing the shrinking?
The shrinking is caused by each additional proton that is added to the element that increases the pull on the electrons. It is the attractive force felt by the nuclear charge. And because we're adding one proton with each element, that attractive force increases and causes a little bit of shrinkage until such time as the shell fills out. And when the shell fills out, it isolates the nuclear charge and allows a little bit of expansion for the next electrons that go in for the valence electrons outside that shell.
Okay, so you add a proton, shrink. Add a proton, shrink.
Yep.
Thank you.
You got it. Okay. Seems like we've got all of those. Let's move from the size to the electronegativity. And for the most part, I'm going to skip the electron affinity, I think. Because electron affinity doesn't serve us as well. I need this to go someplace. And maybe I'll leave it there. I want to bring in the periodic table again so that we can look at electronegativity. Okay, so here what we're going to look at, let's do a definition. Electronegativity is a property that describes how strongly an atom pulls electrons. In a chemical bond. And I guess at the same time, we could define ionization or electron affinity. This is how how much energy is released when an atom captures an electron. It is also a measure of how strongly an element holds electrons. So they're very similar in that they both measure how strongly an atom pulls on or holds electrons. One is specific to actual chemical bonds, whereas the other is an actual measured property by throwing electrons at atoms and seeing how much energy is released when they capture them. The trends are identical. One is measured in kilojoules per mole. The other is unitless. Let's look at the electronegativity trends.
Sir, yeah. What is KT?
KJ. Kilojoules. should be a lowercase k.
So
k j equals kilojoules, where a joule is the amount of energy. Well, actually, I don't know the actual definition of the joule, but the joule is related to a calorie, which is the amount of energy required to raise 1 gram of water by 1 degree Celsius, and it is 4.187 joules to a calorie. And so a joule is just a measurement of an amount of energy, and we're dealing with kilojoules, so this equals joules times 10 to the third for the kilo. So that's how it's measured, kilojoules per mole. So electronegativity, we're going to abbreviate it just as EN, electronegativity. The trend is such that we increase going across the periodic table, and we increase going up a family. And the electronegativities of the halogen, not of the halogens, of the noble gases, they do have electronegativities, but they're generally not very high because they don't want extra electrons. If we think about who wants electrons most on the periodic table, if we think about the element closest to the noble gas, the ones that can get to the noble gas the easiest, fluorine only requires one electron. That fluorine that requires one electron actually is the most electronegative element on the periodic table. So this element is the most electronegative element on periodic table. And it has an electronegativity that is a value 4.0. I don't know where I'm going to write that because I can't fit it in there. Maybe if I get rid of the box on it, maybe I can put in here that this electronegativity is 4.0. And the numbers, if I sort of march across and I look at boron, boron is 2.0, carbon is 2.5, nitrogen is 3.0, oxygen is 3.5, and fluorine is 4.0. The hydrogen over here is 2.1. And then electronegativity wise, all of the elements have electronegativities printed on them that come. Let me grab another chart for a second. See if I can show you something. See if I can find it. Maybe it's in 3.7. This gave us the ion charges, but not the electronegativities. And it's not in, I'm trying to figure out where they hid it. There it is. All right, now I just need to figure out how to get this into the iPad. I can do this.
On the periodic table that I have, I'm trying to see, like, I see where it indicates the electronegativity value.
There we go.
But then I'm also noticing like Roman numerals that are on the top of my elements. What are those?
Good question.
Okay, if you don't know, I'm just wondering.
I don't know what periodic table you're using. It's hard for me to. Roman numerals.
Do you want to see it?
Yeah, you can hold it up. You're so tiny. How do I make you bigger?
You can pin her video and it'll take up your screen.
Ooh, pin video. Sweet. That did work. I don't see the Roman numerals at the top. Oh, I see those. Those are the group numbers. Those are 1A, 2A, 3A. Those are the B values. Yeah, those are the group numbers. So where I have been doing group numbers and I've been writing them out as 1, 2, and 3, those Roman numerals are the group numbers. And traditionally, that's the way the group numbers are done, are by Roman numeral as opposed to our 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
Oh, cool. Thank you.
So those are just group numbers.
Cool.
Sweet. And I have learned how to pin. All right, unpin. Oh, wait, that didn't work. Gallery view. There we go. Okay, I'm back. And all is good in the world, and I can see everybody again. Sweet. Thank you for teaching me something new. Okay. So what I did was I was showing you the trends, and the trends are that electronegativity increases as we go across and increases going up. And here is a table out of your textbook that actually has the electronegativities for each of the elements. And it has the these in purple, which are the metalloids. And then the green are nonmetals. And then the yellowish are the metals. So hydrogen is at 2.1, boron is 2.0, carbon 2.5, nitrogen 3.0, oxygen 3.5, fluorine 4.0. Most electronegative element on the table is fluorine. Chlorine is about as electronegative or equal to nitrogen. And it's not until iodine that I get fairly similar to carbon. So here's the thing. When we compare electronegativities, and I want you to use the trend, when I use the trend, I will ask you the difference in which element is most electronegative, chlorine or bromine, and I will go up and down the table. Or I will ask you which element is most electronegative, phosphorus or sulfur, and I will give you a trend across the table. I will never ask you which is more electronegative, carbon or phosphorus, because you don't know how to use a trend to go across the table in a diagonal way. So unless I give you a table of elements, I will never... is my camera off or am I back on? Can you guys see you? Oh, I'm pinned somehow.
You know, we can see.
No, I see you and your screen share as well.
Oh, okay. All right. So I will never ask you diagonally. I will never ask you about patterns that are diagonal patterns, because you can't assess a diagonal pattern. And so so I would have to give you a table in order to ask you about electronegativity in that direction. But electronegativity is a very important concept that we're going to use as we start going into covalent bonding. So let's skip from here and let's jump into chapter 4. Actually, let's do a time check. It is 11:10. This is a good spot right before we jump into chapter 4 to take a break before we start doing new material. Let's go ahead and take a 10-minute break from here, and then we'll jump in and do something new. So we have a nice, clean spot to make that transition. Sound good? Okay, and I'll scroll up to that page, and I'll leave that there, and we'll take a 10-minute break.
And calorie shells crushed beneath his feet as he comes towards you. He's waving at you. Lift him up to see what you can see. He begins his focusing. He's aiming at you. And now he has got away from memories and close-ups of anything that he has seen or even dreamed. And now he's finished focusing. He's imagining lightning striking seasickness away from here.
who's laughing now that you've wasted how many years and you've barely even tasted anything remotely close to everything you've boasted about. Look who's crying now. Driftwood floats after years of erosion. Incoming tide touches roots to expose them. Quicksand steals my shoes. Clouds bring the F-stop blues. Look who's laughing now that you've wasted how many years, and you've barely even tasted anything remotely close to everything you've boasted about. Look who's crying now.
Now say the sun goes, that's the sound of sunshine.
Okay, time to come back. Let's see, Eric was asking me on the break where that picture is from that I've got up there, a picture that I use as an icon. It's actually a picture of my wife and I, and she's cut out on the right-hand side there. That was taken in Joshua Tree. And I don't have one of the iconic Joshua Trees behind me, but Joshua Tree State Park, or the National Park, Joshua Tree National Park. That is an amazing place, just beautiful. And it's a great, great place to go visit. Okay, let me restart. And let's branch out into chapter 4. And in actuality, we have already started chapter 4. I haven't told you that yet, but I went out of order a little bit, not understanding that the book went out of order from what I thought it was doing. In chapter 3, they introduce ionic compounds at the end of chapter 3, and they give you all of the formulas for all of the polyatomics. And so they introduce polyatomics in chapter 3. And while they introduce those and they talk about the ionic compounds and putting them together, they don't give you any of the nomenclature until chapter 4, which is funny because they talk about ionic bonding in chapter 4. So in chapter 4, what we start going over and start looking at is this is all about ionic bonding and covalent bonding. And within this ionic bonding, they do nomenclature. And that's what we have already been doing. So we've covered this part. So we don't need to jump in and do that part. And then they get into covalent. That's what we're going to start now, is we're going to start looking at covalent bonding. And underneath covalent bonding, then they do Lewis structures, formal charge, and resonance in VSEPR theory. So under this, we do Lewis structures. We do formal charge. And the other thing that we do is what's called Vesper theory, which is three-dimensional shape. So that's what we're going to pick up and do. And as I said, 4.1 was the ionic bonding. We're good there. We don't need to do that. 4.2 starts covalent bonding, and that's what we're going to pick up and do right now. So unlike ionic bonding was cation to anion, and these were held together by electrostatic attraction. Covalent bonding is very different from that. Covalent bonding has to do with bringing together two atoms. And the typical place to start is by looking at hydrogen. If I take two hydrogens and I put them infinitely far apart, and so I consider these hydrogens to be really far apart, and these are not ones, these are electrons, and so this is the 1s orbital, and this is hydrogen's 1s1 electron, essentially. What I can do with those is bring them closer together. And as I bring them closer together, what winds up happening is the two hydrogens get close enough such that the electrons fall into what's called a bonding orbital. And the energy of the system, if I think about this as a graph, what I can do is do a graph that has energy and nuclear distance. Where these are far apart. And what winds up happening in this is that the energy of the system starts off fairly high. And as I get them closer and closer together, the energy of the system comes down to a minimum. And then as I push them closer and closer together, the energy starts going up really fast. And at this point right here, this point where the energy is a minimum, this is what's called the bonding distance. And what the hydrogens are doing is they are essentially taking what is one electron cloud and one electron cloud and bringing those clouds together to make a single cloud that covers the two hydrogens and makes a molecule. And the reason that it makes a molecule is because the electrons are being shared. And the question is, well, why do they share the electrons like this? They share these electrons, in essence, because when I bring two hydrogens together, the energy of the system winds up coming down, becoming more stable. When you make a chemical bond, energy is released, and the system is more stable through having that chemical bond. If we take a look at helium and hydrogen, hydrogen has the electronic configuration 1s1. It has the one electron in the s orbital. Helium, its closest noble gas, has two electrons. And so helium's electronic configuration is 1s2. This is a filled out shell. Or level. And helium is a noble gas. And remember that all of the elements on the periodic table were attempting to be the same as the noble gases, because having that filled energy level is a very stable configuration. So the goal is to try to come up with a filled energy level. There's two ways to accomplish that. Two ways to be like a noble gas. One way is to form an ion. An ion is where I either add or give up, essentially, electrons. The other way is to share electrons. In sharing electrons, what essentially happens is the two hydrogens, as they come together, each one bringing its electron, let's use a dot to represent the electron. As the hydrogen brings these two dots together, and let's make the two hydrogens different colors, that will help too. So we'll make one blue, and we'll make one red. As we bring these two hydrogens together, the electrons are shared between them. And we draw the electrons vertically, one on top of the other. And so whereas we thought of these guys as being atoms all on their own, when they get close enough to share, they share these electrons in an orbital that covers both. And we call this a covalence, where each one of these were the valence electrons. And this one has its valence electrons. The bonding of the two hydrogens together, I used the wrong two. Yes, I did. TWO. I told you. The electrons are shared in what's called a covalence. Co meaning a valence that is a shared valence. So the literal interpretation of this covalence word is a shared valence. And in making a shared valence, each hydrogen feels as though it can count the two electrons for itself. So in other words, when I take and look at this and analyze this molecule, each hydrogen, the red hydrogen, thinks that it can count all of these electrons for itself. And the blue also feels like it can count all of these electrons for itself. And so each atom feels as though it has two electrons, isoelectronic with helium. Now that's one way to think of it, is that in sharing, it's satisfying its need for electrons by sharing. And so the process of sharing gets us to a configuration which is sort of isoelectronic with the noble gas. However, in another sense, it really is different from that. It really is more about waves and adding waves together. When you add waves together, one way to add waves together is to take and to add waves that are in phase. If I take two waves and add two waves that start and end at the same place, and this is what is called in phase, and I can represent this in phaseness as two waves of the same color. When two waves like this add together, they create a wave which is twice the amplitude of the original waves. The waves add together to make a larger wave. This is what's called constructive interference.
Jason, you said two waves of the same color. Do you just mean two waves of the same like wavelength or energy level?
What I mean is that they are, when I look at their, the best word is phase. Phase is representing where a wave starts and where a wave ends. And so literally, if I take an XYZ axis and I put, that was the wrong thing, and I take and I put an XYZ axis on this wave, I'm saying that this wave is starting at zero and peaks at the same time that this wave starts at zero and peaks, and that the waves are identical in phase, so that they are both rising and falling at the same time on the x-axis. When I take two waves and I combine them out of phase, and I will use color to represent this phase again, so we'll take a wave represented here and a wave represented here, and I will add these two waves together. And I will start with a wave. This is very much like what I just did before. So this wave is that phase. The other wave is going to go negative instead of going positive and come down. And so that what we're looking at is that these two are positive and negative at the same time. So they add up essentially to two positives and two negatives. That's in phase. This one is positive and negative, but over here I am negative and positive. When I add these two waves together, these two waves annihilate each other and I get destructive interference. Essentially, what winds up happening is the positive and the negative cancel each other out. The positive and negative cancel each other out, or positive and negative cancel each other out. And so there is no wave. They annihilate each other, and we have destructive interference. Orbitals, wave equations, electrons have phase to them. In other words, When I look at two hydrogens, the hydrogen with its one electron can be in two different phases, or they can be in the same phase. So one option, and I'll use color again, one option is that these two can come together with their orbitals in phase. And I'm going to move these down. We'll do it down here. This will be in phase. When they add together, that makes an orbital where the hydrogens are surrounded by electron density. And this orbital looks kind of like this. In another sense, these two hydrogens can come together in this possibility where they're out of phase. So basically what I'm saying is that these are both positive phase and they add together to make a constructive interference. In another sense, they can come together this way, one of them being positive and one of them being negative. And when that happens, they annihilate each other. And the pattern looks a little skewed, looks a little bit like a dumbbell sort of sitting out this direction. And the H over here, a dumbbell sort of sitting out this direction. And they get a picture that looks like this because they have annihilated each other where they have crossed over. Because when you have two atomic orbitals combining, they can combine in phase or out of phase. The two atomic orbitals always result in two molecular orbitals. This orbital is called a bonding orbital. And this orbital is called an antibonding. We use a different image to represent this picture. What we say is, or the way that we represent this picture, is that when one hydrogen comes with its electron and the other hydrogen comes with its electron, that those two orbitals combine together in a constructive and destructive way. And the two electrons fall into the bonding orbital. And the antibonding orbital is empty. When this happens, this energy difference right here, if we think about this as increasing in energy, so that this is really an energy diagram, this energy diagram, the difference in energy between my starting point and this bonding orbital, that difference in energy is the energy that is released when a chemical bond is made and is the reason a chemical bond is made. This is a very important concept, in that the reason that elements bond, number one, because the electrons are being shared such that the elements become sort of isoelectronic with the noble gases. But number two, because when I make a bond, the molecule is more stable than the atoms on their own. That goes back to this picture here, that the atoms on their own are higher in energy than when they come together in bond, they come down in energy. And this energy difference, what we're looking at from this level here to this level here, this difference in energy equals the energy released in making the bond. So there's a misconception that gets perpetuated a lot here. When you make something, you think about the effort that you need to put into it to make something. If you're going to make a cabinet, if you're going to make a paper airplane, if you're going to make a building, you think that you need to exert energy in order to make something. But the opposite is true in the case of molecules. When molecules come together and they make a bond, energy is released in that process, such that the making of a bond releases energy. Think about taking two magnets and giving two magnets the plus and minus together, and then they get so close that when you let them go, they snap together, right? That snapping together, that snapping together that they do is a release in energy, and the system has expended potential energy and released it as kinetic energy, in essence, released it as heat and released it as energy that goes out of the system. And the system has become more stable because of that release in energy. That is the reason that things bond. Number one, they're sharing electrons to become like a noble gas. Number two, they're releasing energy in the process of making the bond, becoming more stable. So what determines, like fusion, yes, in a way like fusion. When we do fusion, there's a huge release of energy in fusion because you are fusing atoms together. And in the process, you're making something that is more stable. And so you are releasing all that potential energy that was there before the two were fused. And Eric, what determines the phase of the various electrons, or the valence electrons? That's a good question. And the answer to that question is time. That the orbitals, while I didn't show you this, and it's very difficult to show you this, if you think about a traveling wave, Eric, that's a great question too. When you think about a traveling wave changes phase all the time. So that if I go through positive, negative, positive, negative, that a traveling wave is going from positive to negative to positive to negative to positive to negative. It's alternating all the time. A standing wave alternates in the same way, but a standing wave, I can't show you how it alternates in the same way. So this is my standing wave, and this is time. And that standing wave is alternating between, is alternating between positive and negative in time. That the phase of the standing wave changes as time progresses, in the same way that a traveling wave moves and changes negative to negative to negative to positive to positive to positive. And so it is just the possibility that these could be in different phases that result in the two different waves, one being a bonding and one being an anti-bonding. And the bonding is always lower in energy, allowing these two to come together and bond. So here's a thing that we have not talked about, which is really curious and fun to look at. Hydrogen likes to form a diatomic molecule. Diatomic meaning two atoms in a molecule sharing electrons. Helium likes to be monatomic. Why? When hydrogen comes together and shares its electrons, the result of the sharing produces a bonding orbital in which the two electrons sit and are more stable than they were originally, and there is a release in energy. So the bonding is more stable. By more stable, we mean lower in energy. If you do the same thing with helium, helium has two electrons. When helium comes together, it comes together in much the same way, making a bonding and antibonding orbital. But now when we put electrons into it, the electrons fill in the exact same way that we fill any energy diagram. And what happens is, this one being the bonding, and this one being the antibonding, offset each other. And there is no energy gain. No loss in energy instead of gain. That'll make more sense. No loss in energy.
Which makes it a much more stable gas for balloons.
In a way, yes. In a way.
Compared to hydrogen, right?
Well, it's not that helium is more stable than hydrogen. That's an interesting question, Jeremy. It's not that hydrogen, that helium is more stable than hydrogen, although it is. Hydrogen is actually smaller than helium. And so if you think about the balloon as porous, the hydrogen leaks out of a balloon a lot faster than helium does. So it is true that helium does not react chemically with other things and therefore is more stable. But the reason that we use helium in a balloon is not only because it's safer, but also because it lasts longer, because it's a larger molecule and it does not diffuse through the balloon as quickly. So, Ellis, let's see. So the likelihood of two atoms with the same phase finding each other unbelievably low, then no. When we say the same phase, what we mean is that there is the possibility. The phases, when I say they go back and forth in time and they switch back and forth between these phases, it's happening at like smaller than attosecond, 1 × 10⁻¹⁵. This phase transition is happening so fast that the likelihood of two atoms finding each other in phase or out of phase is not a factor of time as much as it is probability, in that because it's probabilistic, because they can, we get both. In other words, we always get both. We never just get a bonding or an antibonding. We always get bonding and antibonding. It is two orbitals combined to form two orbitals. In this sense, 1 + 1 = 1 + 1. And I have to get two orbitals that come out for every two orbitals that I put in. That's the way that orbitals work when you add them together. And so I always get both. So it's a little bit different than what you're thinking. Okay. Let's move from this orbital picture into a slightly different picture. And that is, what I do with these hydrogens then is where I can represent the sharing of the electron as two dots. It is more common to represent it as a horizontal line, as a bond, and it means the same thing, the sharing of two electrons. So each line between two atoms in a picture like this represents the sharing of two electrons, and this is a chemical bond equals the sharing of two or more electrons. Usually two, but we'll get into some other pictures. And this sharing is proportional to how electronegative the elements are. In other words, when I think about the sharing of these electrons, it is literally a tug of war between the two different hydrogens that are hanging onto this rope that has got the electrons in it. We can think of the electrons as sort of like a flag that is sitting on this rope. And so I've got the flag that is sitting here, and these two hydrogens are tugging on this and trying to fight for the electrons. And what we find is that these guys are twins, and neither one of them can pull the electrons more than the other. And what results in this is a bond that is an equal bond and equal sharing. That equal sharing we call a non-polar bond. And it happens because we're looking at the electronegativity values. Electronegativity of this first hydrogen is 2.1. And if I subtract the electronegativity of the second hydrogen, which is also 2.1, I get what is called a difference in electronegativity, which is equal to zero. In other words, there is no difference. We can contrast this picture or image of hydrogen with fluorine. Now, fluorine has more electrons, and let's change fluorine's color to represent this guy, and hydrogen will be smaller. And the way that I'm drawing these images, or these dots, because I've just changed representations here, so this is kind of important, is this is what is called a Lewis dot structure. A Lewis dot structure takes an element and treats the element as if it has a box around it. And on each side, I can hold two electrons on a side. These electrons are the valence electrons for the element. And the valence electrons are determined by the group number. So when we look at fluorine, fluorine's electronic configuration is 1s2, 2s2, 2p5. That is fluorine's electronic configuration. Its valence electrons are the highest principal energy level. That is 5, 6, 7, that is 7 valence electrons. Fluorine is in group 5, 6, 7, 7A. The 7 here means 7 valence electrons. So the group number tells you directly how many valence electrons each element has without having to go and look at their entire electronic configuration. And so what is represented here for fluorine is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. There's fluorine's 7th electron. And fluorine and hydrogen are coming together to make a bond. And in this bond, what winds up happening is the electrons are not shared equally. The electrons actually get pulled by fluorine. And if I look at the orbital that gets created from this, the orbital that gets created has a little bit of orbital around hydrogen and then a big massive orbital around fluorine. And if I think about this as a tug of war, the picture really changes. The picture of fluorine is that fluorine is really big. And in this tug of war, hydrogen is really small. His electronegativity is tiny. And so they're tugging on these electrons, but the tug of war is being won by the fluorine. That if I looked at sort of where the middle was, fluorine has pulled the electron. Now remember that electrons are negatively charged. So given that electrons are negatively charged, fluorine is getting more than its share of electrons. Fluorine is taking on a partial negative charge, and hydrogen is taking on a partial positive charge. This is creating a difference in charge, which is called a dipole. And the symbol that I am using, this little symbol, is a lowercase d in the Greek alphabet, and it stands for delta. or in this case, we're using it as partial. So this means not a full charge, but a partial charge. And if I look at it in terms of electronegativity, I'm going to have to switch pictures. Let's copy this and take this to a new spot. We're getting just too complicated in here. We're too cramped in the space.
Are we approaching the reason why water has its fluidity, like that hydrogen has the positive, like the hydrogen side of the water molecule has the, okay.
Yes, that is exactly what we're approaching. Yes. And so what happens here is that this molecule is called polar and has what is called a dipole. And it stems from the electronegativities that hydrogen, when I look at the electronegativity, it's 2.1. And fluorine, the electronegativity is 4.0. And so these are my electronegativity values. And the change in electronegativity, the difference, so this is a capital delta, this is going to mean difference, is defined as the absolute value of electronegativity 1 subtract electronegativity 2. So to do this for fluorine, what we say is the difference in electronegativity is going to equal the absolute value of 4.0 subtract 2.1. And that's going to equal a value, which in this case is going to be 1.9. The difference in electronegativity tells me how far skewed the bonding is. Ellis, which symbol? The triangle or the EN, the delta? The delta, so there's two different deltas. One delta that I'm using, this is also delta. This is a capital delta. This is usually implied to mean difference. And then this is a lowercase delta. And this is supposed to be smooth. This lowercase delta usually implies partial. Can also mean difference, but that's the way in which we're using them, is one is difference and one is partial. And in terms of these electronegativities, what we have is a continuum, electronegativity continuum. Continue. Why can't I spell that? All right, screw it. It's just a list of electronegativities. And electronegativity, the difference in electronegativity can go from zero on up to something that is usually, I don't know, big. We don't put a limit on it. But there are some important points. 0.4 and 1.8. Sometimes certain books will list it at 1.7. So certain books will list it at a different value. If we are in the 0 to 1.4, we call this range nonpolar. And this means that the sharing is equal of the electrons. If we're in the range greater than 0.4, so as we move this direction, we are greater than 0.4. And yet less than 1.8, we call this polar. And this says that the sharing of the electrons is unequal. If we are greater than 1.8, so I should really amend this to say greater than 1.4, I should do 0.4 bigger than. As we get out here, greater than 1.8, we call this ionic. And this means that there is not sharing, but we have cation and anion, full cation and anion. And so this represents a continuum of things that are equal sharing, nonpolar, only results when we have a difference that is less than or equal to 0.4. If we get a difference bigger than 0.4 up into including 1.8, we call that polar, and that is a type of covalent bonding. So covalent bonding extends in there. Over here, if the difference in electronegativity is bigger than that, then that becomes ionic. And so where do these magic values of 0.4 and 1.8 or 1.7 come from? I've already kind of alluded to it in that some textbooks will call this value 1.7. This is a man-made determined scale that we arbitrarily drew a line and decided to say, at this point, anything below that is going to be polar, nonpolar. Anything in between is going to be polar. And if it's greater than this, it demonstrates certain properties that we then call it ionic. So this is a continuum of bonding that shows us all the different possibilities and yet some distinct divisions or dividing lines that allow us to be able to call things nonpolar and other things polar. Okay, I've been talking for quite a while and I've seen a few things come across the chat. So I'm looking to see, based on observations through years, yes, absolutely. Based on many, many, many observations. This is the scale that we have come up with. Okay, and so, and as Jeremy alluded to, we can now take any molecule and we can look at a molecule in the way that the molecule shares electrons. And the question was regarding water. And many of us know that water is a polar molecule, but we don't understand what that means. And we may even know that that sort of means that maybe it has partial positives and partial minus. And the answer is, well, maybe why? Let's look at the difference in electronegativity between oxygen and hydrogen. So I want to do the difference in electronegativity of oxygen and hydrogen. Now, these are values that I would have to look up, and I would have to have a table of these values. And we did. We brought a table of these values in. We did it earlier. So we can go back and we can see what their electronegativities are. Hydrogen was 2.1, and oxygen was 3.5. So having those values, we can now apply that difference in electronegativity, and we say that delta En is equal to the absolute value of electronegativity of the hydrogen minus the electronegativity of the oxygen. And why do I do it absolute value? Because electronegativity differences are always a positive value. So I always take the absolute value. And that allows me to do this operation in any order. I could do it electronegativity of oxygen minus hydrogen or hydrogen minus oxygen. And when I take the absolute value, I'll get the same value. So it doesn't matter what order I place them in. Out of convenience, I always place the higher value first. So oxygen was 3.5 and hydrogen was 2.1. And the difference in electronegativity then is 1.4. 1.4 on that scale of electronegativities puts me here. So here was 0.4. Here was my 1.8. And I'm right in this zone at 1.4. This is the polar region, and this is the nonpolar, and this is ionic. And that just keeps on going, that scale. And so this molecule, this water molecule, is said to be polar. And that polar represents the difference in the bonding between hydrogen and oxygen in that the sharing is not equal. The sharing in that oxygen-hydrogen bond looks somewhat like this. here's the two electrons, and here's the little guy fighting for the electrons, and here is oxygen, which I said before, and I think I said it in the morning lab, that when I teach organic chemistry, I tend to anthropomorphize the elements a little bit, and I call oxygen the 800-pound gorilla of the periodic table, and that oxygen likes to pull electrons more strongly than does other elements. And so if this were the equal line, oxygen is winning this tug of war.
Wouldn't there be two hydrogens?
There are, but when I focus on the polarity of a bond, I only focus on one bond at a time. So I don't need to look at the other hydrogen. The other hydrogen is going to be identical to this one, and I only look at the picture one bond at a time. I isolate that bond, see what's going on with that bond, and apply it to only that one bond at a time. So yes, those are good questions from both you and Eric. And so what that does is, that sets up that this oxygen gets a little more electron density, and the hydrogen loses out. And that sets up the dipole. And this arrow that I'm using, that is a dipole, it's like a bar magnet, and it has two ends. One end, the arrow, points towards the negative. And the tail towards the positive. And the size of the arrow represents the size of the difference. This small arrow equals small difference in electronegativity. A large arrow would represent a large difference.
Sorry, I just want to clear one thing up about the, when you're doing like the two hydrogens and then one oxygen example. So is there a reason why you do, you don't multiply the NE or the EN by?
Yes, Ellis, the reason that we're doing that is the same thing that Kai and Eric had mentioned. They asked, why don't I put or in this drawing, why don't I show both hydrogens at the same time? And the answer is that I look at a single bond at a time. I don't look at two bonds, or I'm not trying to figure out for the entire molecule. That's a great question. Actually, your question is a little bit different and intuitive in a way. Let me address your question, which comes at the end of all these chapters, at the end of chapter 4.6. We deal with what is called molecular polarity, whether a molecule is polar versus a bond. So when I look at water, both of the bonds in water are polar. Oxygen is partial minus, and each hydrogen is partial positive. They each have small vectors that point in this direction towards the oxygen. But there is a net vector that is the vector for the entire water molecule. And this is the net vector.
Gotcha. And so it's not like oxygen is using up its electronegativity, like energy or whatever.
Correct.
On each, it's just like the entire amount counts for both. I got it.
Correct. And so what's going to happen is, right now, this is our focus now. Our focus now is on single bonds, one at a time. Later, we will shift our focus to the net dipole and trying to figure out what the net dipole looks like, the adding of the two dipole moments. And it literally is a mathematical operation. These are called vectors. Vectors possess both a size and magnitude, direction. I want to say direction and magnitude. I shouldn't say size. I should say magnitude and direction. because that's what a vector is. A vector is something that communicates both magnitude and direction. And so those arrows that we're drawing are vectors in the true mathematical sense of the word. And graph paper would come in handy, which is why, all of a sudden now we can switch to graph paper and doing our things there. Okay, what do I need to show you now? We've covered everything in 4.2. The only things left to cover in 4.3 moves into nomenclature. And in 4.3, they cover both the ionic nomenclature, which we already did this, and the next thing that they cover is what is called covalent nomenclature. And we will do this tomorrow. So we'll pick it up in 4.3 with covalent nomenclature tomorrow. And we are now at 2:15. And rather than start off on a new topic, I feel like that's a good place to cut it. So let's take some questions if you guys have any. I'm sure we've covered a lot of interesting material today. And I would not be surprised if there's questions floating around on the things that we've covered. Yeah, and office hours today, 3:30 to 5:15, same as usual. I'll be there. And you guys can jump in at any time. So, if anybody's looking for me in office hours, I'll be there today. Any upcoming due dates? Not just yet. I want you guys to try to finish that test if you haven't done so already. So that's one thing to finish. And then I did put a suggested homework set for chapter 3 up, so you guys can work on that. And then I will work on getting other assignments with new due dates up. That's my job tonight. Anything else?
Yeah, for the line that goes between the, in our example, the two hydrogen atoms, we had said it's the sharing of two electrons. Is that why sometimes there's two lines? Is that it's the sharing of four electrons?
That is correct. Each line represents two electrons. And so sometimes what we have are multiple bonds. Sometimes we can have bonds, for instance, in carbon dioxide, the carbon makes a double bond with oxygen. In hydrogen cyanide, the nitrogen makes a triple bond with, that's the wrong direction. It's the carbon that's in the middle. The carbon makes a triple bond with the nitrogen. So this would be the sharing of four electrons. This is the sharing of six electrons. So yes, multiple bonds represent the sharing of multiple electrons. Yeah, spot on.
Thank you.
Yeah. Anything else come up for anybody?
How is that six electrons?
Each line represents the sharing of two. So 2, 4, 6.
Oh, okay. I thought the four electrons was for the total for this. But that makes more sense.
Yeah, each line represents, each horizontal line we're saying is the sharing of two electrons. So when I draw carbon with three bonds to nitrogen, then what I'm saying is that that carbon is sharing 2, 4, 6, and each one of those represents the line, the sharing of the two electrons. Okay, you guys are feeling good? We had a good discussion today. We're really starting to get into the chemistry. This is getting kind of fun. The mathematical part is always a little bit rough. And then you start getting into the chemistry part and it starts to get kind of interesting and fun. And you start learning about how matter is actually constructed and put together and why it is the way it is. And once you start getting that understanding, the smiles start coming out and Yeah, it's always a good feeling when you start to understand why things are the way that they are, as opposed to somebody just telling you because they are. That's a very unsatisfactory answer, because they are. So that doesn't help us any bit. All right. So let's take a break. I'm going to go get some lunch before I got to go do my interview thing at 1 o'clock. Remember, no afternoon lab. I'll send out an email to the same so that everybody gets that information, just in case we miss people in today's lecture. And then I will get the lecture notes up as soon as I can this evening, and office hours from 3:30 to 5:15. And that's the whole shebang for today.
Thank you, sir.
You're welcome. We'll see you back same bat time, same bat channel. Thank you, guys. Thanks, Noelle.